In the past 2.5 years, the United States has unseated 2 governments in the Islamic world and has worked to replace them with constitutional democracies. The effort has been backed up with military, economic, and diplomatic power. Critics of American foreign policy have accused the United States of harboring imperial ambitions. Some conservative commentators have embraced the term empire, saying it reflects a new global reality. But President Bush routinely insists, as he did at West Point's commencement in 2002, that America has no empire to extend or utopia to establish. Neil Ferguson is the author of Colossus, The Price of America's Empire, and Walter Russell Mead's new book is Power, Terror, Peace, and War, America's Grand Strategy in a World at Risk. We spoke with both gentlemen from our New York bureau and have divided our conversation into 2 parts. In the first part today, Walter Russell Mead starts by explaining his use of the term the American Project and how it differs from an American empire.
You possibly could describe the American Project as an American empire, and particularly because, as Neil knows very well, we inherited a lot of this, the American Project, from the British Empire. The American system, the American Project, is trying to create a sort of an enduring, peaceful order in the world. At least in theory, people are hoping that other countries will benefit economically so much by participating in this American system that they won't want to challenge it. That China, for example, would much rather get rich selling stuff to the United States and getting investment from the United States, and that makes it happy enough so that it doesn't feel that for China to be what China wants to be, it has to mount some kind of a military challenge to this American framework.
Neil Ferguson, you're very explicit in your book that America is an empire, but you go a little bit further. You call it an empire in denial. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think Walter's rather perfectly illustrated what I mean in what he said, because, of course, precisely what the British said they were doing 100 years ago is what Walter says that the Americans are doing today. In other words, offering some kind of global order in which everybody can achieve prosperity. The British insisted that their vision of a free trade global economy based on capital flows from London out to the periphery was the only way that that the world was going to enrich itself. And in that sense, I think the proclamations that Americans make today about their project sound uncannily familiar. They really do sound pretty much like the same things liberal imperialists were saying exactly a century ago about the British project. The only difference is that the British knew they were an empire and were indeed rather proud of it. Whereas what's so charming about the American empire is that the Americans themselves, who dominate the world economically and culturally and of course militarily, deny vehemently, as you yourself said, Leanne, over and over again, that they're in the empire business. I think it's rather sweet, but it's also rather naive.
You're both very comfortable with this idea of American power playing a large role, an active role in the world. So let's talk about Iraq as an example. How effectively is the United States wielding its military and economic power there? And Walter, let's start with you.
I think the Bush administration had a very large margin of error when they went into Iraq, that there are a lot of structural reasons why Iraq at the end of the day should look, if not as beautifully democratic as, say, Switzerland or something, should look a lot more like the United States wants it to look than it looked under Saddam Hussein. Unfortunately, they have been burning through their margin of safety at a fairly rapid rate. The U.S. is losing influence, I think, over the political future of Iraq. But I think it's a little bit early still to say that they've failed.
What do you think, Neil?
We're leaping to premature judgment when we say things are going wrong after barely a year of occupation. That said, I'd give a grade in old Oxford terms of alpha gamma. Alpha for the regime change, but right now gamma for the nation building. You've got to recognize that this kind of stuff takes years, not months. And if you go for a premature transfer of power under present circumstances, you could end up with something a little like Haiti on the Tigris.
I'd like to bring up something, a charge that often gets leveled whenever the discussion turns to the idea of liberal empire or the American project. I mean, using whatever terminology you want. But very often it's said that what we're seeing is just another example of the wealthy, white, educated West imposing its values and its culture on the rest of the world. And I'd like to get you both to respond to it. Walter, how would you respond to that chart?
Well, I'd say that one of the signs that that isn't true is that probably the biggest growth area for democracy and economic progress and capitalism is East Asia. And that less and less does this way of organizing the world wear a white face. I would also point to a country like South Africa and the African National Congress, where you are really seeing a very deep commitment to political pluralism and free markets taking really deep roots in an African liberation movement. I mean, I think that's one of the differences between the British Empire of a century ago and our Virtuous American project of today. That is that people used to talk about the Anglo-Saxon race or the white race and its destiny to rule the world. That kind of thinking, and I think that reality plays a much less important role in the way the world is working now.
Neil, give you a chance to respond as well.
It seems to me that the key point about liberal empire is precisely that it provides international public goods, to use a rather clumsy economic term. That's to say, by providing a framework of international order within which free trade and international capital flows can do their work, the United States, just as Britain did a century ago, is creating opportunities for poorer countries to enrich themselves. And the proof of this, which of course the dear old anti-globalization people hate to admit because it spoils their wonderful post-Marxist conspiracy theory, is that the poor people of the world, in the most populous poor countries of the world, have rapidly begun to raise their incomes in the last 10 or 15 years of real globalization. That's in China, and of course in India too, which is now growing as fast, if not faster than China. And so one has to recognize that there has been an era of globalization before, that it did in fact raise living standards in poorer countries, and that it wouldn't have worked so well if there hadn't been an imperial policeman enforcing and underwriting it. And I think that's as true today.
Neil Ferguson is Herzog Professor of Financial History at the Stern School of Business at New York University and the author of Colossus, The Price of America's Empire, published by the Penguin Press. Walter Russell Mead is the Henry A. Kissinger Senior Fellow in U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book, Power, Terror, Peace, and War, America's Grand Strategy in a World at Risk, is published by Knopf. Both gentlemen joined us from our New York Bureau. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Next week, we'll continue our conversation with Neil Ferguson and Walter Russell Mead when they will discuss the economics of American empire.